Welcome to the Transatlanticist Politics Podcast at the American Centrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola, and today we'll be doing our 2024 year in review, as well as a preview of the year 2025. And here with me today is our resident EU expert and newly elected member of the board of the American Centrum, Dr. Günter Donner. Congratulations, Günter. Welcome to the team.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for the congratulations.
So let's jump right into it. I think we can describe 2024 as a year of political change in Atlantic democracies. From the USA to France and Germany, we've seen pretty major changes affected at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., Donald Trump rose like Lazarus from the political grave to win the presidential election. In France, President Macron's party was soundly defeated in parliamentary elections in July, leading to gridlock in the French legislature. The gridlock in turn led to the ouster of Macron's handpicked prime minister, Michel Barnier, in December, just this month. And Barnier has just been replaced by a Macron ally, but it's unclear if the French legislature will be able to function normally. And I think they still don't have a budget for 2025, just like Germany. In Germany, years of tension in the government coalition led to the early collapse of Chancellor Scholz's government in November, just a day after the U.S. election, coincidentally or not, for you conspiracy theorists out there. Chancellor Scholz then lost a confidence vote and parliament was annulled and new elections are scheduled for the end of February. Of course, these national elections have huge ramifications internally, so in their own countries, in the US, in France, in Germany. Obviously, what happens in France and Germany also affects the European Union. But they also have huge ramifications on the other issues that face the world in 2024 and will continue to face us in 2025. And here I'm talking about the war in Ukraine, international trade and tariffs, relations with China, and of course, migration, and the continuing rise of right-wing parties in Europe and the US. Mm-hmm. So, Günter, let's start quickly with the situation in France.
Yes.
Before then turning to Germany and the US. So what's going on in France, and how is Macron going to affect change in France and Europe when he is increasingly seen as a very weak French president?
He definitely is in a critical position. I shouldn't call him a weak politician because The French president is, in all democracies throughout the world, the most powerful office there is in democracies, not dictatorships. His role as president, I mean, there were rumors he had to resign, all this nonsense. He would never do that. His problem is as follows, very quickly. His own party has never been a party. When he came up out of nothing, his party was more or less a grouping or a movement of his personal supporters. So that has improved a bit, mostly with runaways from other camps. His problem is that his party isn't organized as such all too well. Now, what has happened in France? The center, the political center has evaporated. It doesn't exist anymore. The once powerful parties, the socialists from the left side or the Gaullists, let's call them the Gaullists, foreign Anglo-Saxon listeners may understand what we talk about because French parties tend to change the names every now and then. So the Gaullists have been reduced to a small minority, and so have the socialists. They don't exist anymore as mighty forces of the political gamble in France. The center thus has been weakened with a few Gaullists, leftovers, and the Macron movement, I call it. So the center is a weak spot. On the radical sides, you have an extremely active extreme right under the command of Madame Le Pen, and you have a new, equally aggressive and equally radical left-wing bloc that amalgamated all the splinter fractions of the left eco and anarcho scene in France, and they have quite a substantial amount of this. So what is Macron heading for? Macron has to wait until 27. In 27, he will not be able to run again for president for one period. After 5 years, he could come back if he so wished. So in 27, the question is, who is going to replace Macron as a candidate, and where would this person come from? And that indeed is a question you probably can't answer today. What his strategy is now quite clear to see. Barnier was his first choice. He knew what that would lead to. But it led to, and that is something an American president could just dream of, that certain political crucial decisions can be pushed through by the president using a certain article of the French Constitution without a supporting majority in Parliament. So they will never be there with a shutdown of the enormous French state. I mean, that couldn't be imagined. It would lead to total chaos, contrary to America. But what Macron is waiting for is he would like to blow up either the right-wing centre, which is more difficult because it's much more united than the left radical bloc. The right-wing is Madame Le Pen and a few creeping around her, and a few Gaullists who wish to cooperate with Madame Le Pen. The left bloc is totally inhomogeneous. It's totally more or less parties hating each other. But they all agree that we are now against Macron. And they even voted against Barnier with the extreme right. So Macron is their enemy number one, not the extreme right. What he's waiting for is, could he arrive at a situation where the left radical bloc blows apart and probably some socialists come out, and the third prime minister will then be from this party. That might put an end to the left-wing bloc in Parliament. The second hope he has is that Madame Le Pen is facing, and she's accused, or her whole party, a whole ring and network of people, of illegal transactions.
Yeah, they take cash from Vladimir Putin, right?
No, it's not that. A misuse of party funding in the European Parliament.
I thought in the past they had received funding.
They had received loans, but that isn't forbidden.
Or at the time it wasn't forbidden, it just smells bad.
Yeah, but what they did in the European Parliament is far more serious. They had fictive employees, and all the money was sucked in and used for party purposes. So the Attorney General, to my knowledge, demanded an imprisonment of Madame Le Pen for 5 years. And whatever she might be condemned to puts pay to her political career. There is no way out, as you can run away with all what Trump did. No chance. If you think about Sarkozy, once a president and a respected and feared president, is now at home with electronic security devices around his leg for corruption.
He's also probably surrounded by fine wines. But,
certainly, yeah, but he's a teetotaler.
But Gunther, in your discussion here, again, I understand that the role or the powers of the French presidency are strong.
Yeah.
Macron is still, everything you said confirms that he's a weak politician. He has to constantly fend off internal forces in French politics, which means he cannot be the leader of Europe that he would like to be.
Well, that comes free of charge to him. Because Scholz definitely has never been a leader, not even attempted to become one.
But Germany, Macron is no leader of Europe. Europe is floundering, pretty much everyone says, because Macron is under fire at home. And yes, Scholz has proven not to be effective, well, and is on the way out anyway.
France is the sole resting nuclear power Europe has. And given the total uncertainty of what American foreign and security politics will look like in the near future, this gains in momentum. And be assured that once Macron has the leverage to deliver that he is the savior of Europe due to French strength, and German weakness, he will find people joining in him. A Frenchman rests a Frenchman with a few exceptions.
Well, I have to then just wait for that to happen, because we've been waiting a long time for a new European leader to emerge, and it hasn't happened yet. So maybe Macron will be that person.
I personally quite doubt it. That Mrs. Merkel no longer holds this office, because what she did wasn't to our advantage. That is clear.
So Macron has to battle his internal fights, which distracts him from other things that he'd like to do in the EU. And in fact, the mantle is waiting, European leader mantle is waiting for him, because, of course, the German government collapsed after years of tension with the three-way coalition.
Yes.
So again, just one day after the U.S. election, the German government coalition officially collapsed. And let me just remind everyone of the three-way coalition that was leading the government.
Mm-hmm.
So first it was the center-left Social Democrats, and then they were joined by the Greens and the Free Democrats,
mm-hmm.
who are an economically liberal party. So they stand for lower taxes and smaller government. So Günther Scholz will not be the leader of Europe because his coalition collapsed. Why do you think his coalition collapsed?
Let me just explain what we understand by these three German parties involved. The Social Democrats are clear, they're socialists, democratic socialists, so red. The Greens are Greens, and they are mildly to very radical ecologists, but that varies within the party, that varies within the region in Germany they come from. The third party, with a yellow color as a party color, is the so-called Freie Demokratin, the liberal party. It's not liberal in the sense the Americans use this word. It's just a party for people with a higher income, and it serves their interests. So if you wish to pay less tax, and we pay a huge amount of tax compared to what you do, you might vote for them. So they've never been a strong party. So a smaller grouping between not represented in parliament, less than 5% of the votes, or I think their record was once 12.8 or 13.2, that's many years ago. What they stand for really is uncertain. But this coalition was at the time, it was the only way out to form a government. But had the Bolsheviks, there was a traditional communist party who gained three direct votes into parliament and thereby a small little amount of seats, had they been stronger, I'm convinced Scholz, a born opportunist, would have partied with those and the Greens, and that would have put that would have equaled a disaster for Germany right from the beginning. So the FDP was the man on the break in this coalition, against radical eco-politics, against debts to play your electorate, to play games with them, or to stimulate them into voting for you. So what we have, and many Republicans would be happy about that, is a constitutional limit for state debt. That's the reason why our state debt by European and international comparison is comparatively low. But it's a very blunt instrument, because we have reached a position where the government no longer can react. And that has to be discussed. At least the new government has to find answers to that. So they went along. They had a perfect agenda. Miracles from everywhere. An ecological miracle, an economical miracle, generated by the greening or whatever, greenwashing of society and retraining of our citizens. Nothing of that ever materialized, because Putin started a war. So they had to throw away all their plans to come up with something new, taking into account Putin's aggression. And that was a drawback, a major drawback for them. They started somewhere, but they had to do something totally different. In the end, they pleased nobody. And that was the mood right after the military aggression of February. They were voted into office in September 21, and as early as late February, when the war started, all their plans and their coalition treaties was more or less paper. So they had to rethink the whole thing, and that didn't work perfectly well. The CDU had been humiliated during the 21 election with a totally unfit candidate, a product of Mrs. Merkel's, I have to admit. And now, out of the ashes, this Merz reappeared on the scene. And it took him about a year and a half to at least lead in polling. Quite a impressive, it's not an impressive number. He will never be able to govern by himself. So he needs a coalition partner. That's the other side of the medal. But he reappeared, and Merz, and maybe it's here the time where to add a few of his biography. He was a businessman. He's a lawyer, a businessman. He was not a very popular politician because he's a bit elitist. When he was kicked out of politics by Frau Merkel in the early 2000s, he started a world career for a huge international financial company. And he made a substantial amount of money, and he was very successful. And many people do not wish to see politicians to be successful in this way, economically successful for their own benefit. So contrary to American perceptions, at least from years gone by, where personal achievement counted, this was all made you suspicious. So Merz,
I think it's important to stress that point, that the American model of having achieved something in your private life over many
years, the other way around,
is a positive thing for a politician to show in the U.S.
With you, not
in
here.
The U.S., yeah. Mm. In Germany, that is not the case.
It's right the contrary.
And Merz, in that sense, Merz, who has achieved so much, and he's a jet, he flies his own jets and this and that. He's very much not the type of non-charismatic politician that we're familiar with in German history.
Indeed. He's totally the opposite. And he was
There are reasons why charisma in German politics are found upon historical reasons.
Well, yes. We never had business people because so many business, grand names of German business had been involved with the Nazis. So there they were dancing around the Nazis, but for obvious reasons. I mean, they had few alternatives, but so they chose to benefit rather than to be persecuted. So many great names from the German economy had been ruined by their partnership with the Nazi regime. So Merz started, and I remember personal contact with him in the early 2000s or late 90s. He was a bit of a cold, very clear-thinking, cold man, but he has changed enormously. When you watch how he changed, how he addresses problems now, and how he did it 20 years ago, that is remarkable. He is a proven leader, not just a... many German politicians have a career as civil servants because that's so comfortable. You can go to parliament, you are promoted in absence, and you come back if your political career fails, and you find yourself two stages further up in the hierarchy.
Yeah, and in Washington, D.C., there's a similar merry-go-round.
Yeah, but you don't have the type of civil servants we have. Once a civil servant, the rest is civil
servant. Not as extensive, correct. There are
for
some.
For your lifetime.
There are career civil servants, too. But yeah, carry on.
So, Merz changed, and Merz, of course, due to his self-presentation, he managed to make the FDP as a liberal correctional institution for political definitions and solutions completely useless. Why should you vote for Herr Lindner, who knows very little and has never been very successful in anything? Why should you vote for Herr Lindner when there's Merz you could vote for? But Merz also managed with his Catholicism and with his... To at least present an understanding of a welfare state. And let's not forget that our Conservative Party and pro-market and pro-Euro party CDU-CSU, and even it's a democratic right, they are strong supporters of our welfare state, because without a welfare state, or killing the welfare state, you'd be dead in Germany.
And I think that's another important point to make, the differences between conservatives in Europe and conservatives in the US, by and large.
And please, believe me, it's my other half, and in England. Because our conservatives, they got completely blown away with one idiot following the other.
Conservatives in the US, for example, want to get rid of Social Security, and Medicare and Medicaid. CDU candidate in Germany to suggest eliminating the German pension system. Or
he could use his revolver, that would be quicker.
Yeah, I mean, it's political suicide.
Completely. And happily, I'm glad that it is this way. Because what your people and your poor people, and from my stays in America, being poor in America and being poor here is a huge difference.
Yeah, I'd rather be poor definitely in Germany than I would in the US.
Yeah, okay. I know the reason why.
Good. Let's look at the polls. I pulled up the most recent polls from Politico on the 28th of December, looking at the elections coming up in February. So Merz and his party are at 30%. The AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, is at 19%. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk just endorsed them. We'll see if the number changes because mm-hmm. of Musk's endorsement. That'll be interesting. If it doesn't change at all, it will show that Musk's brand of intervening in national politics is not exportable. Then the SPD has 17%, the Greens 14%, the Bundeswehrwagenknecht has 4%. I'm sorry, 6%. The FDP has 4%, and the Linke, the old left, has 3%. And you'll note, if you add up those numbers, no two of those parties together would reach 50%. So that's where we stand now, and those numbers will change. Maybe, Günther, you can discuss which are the top three issues that the German people will be voting on in the elections in February.
That depends a little on the individual German voter's place of origin. Where does he or she live? How educated are they? And how easily are they under a spell of whatever political witchcraft that's around? The normal hierarchy, and that is for the majority, is economic recovery and welfare state. That goes intertwined. That you cannot separate the one from the other, because without an economic sound economic system, the German generosity of the welfare state would be impossible. The other is, of course, illegal immigration. That is a huge issue. And let me just start with the differences to your situation. When I was in America many decades ago, the illegals, mostly from Mexico, then, were welcome. They were doing the slave work in California on the plantations. I was flabbergasted to learn that as an illegal in America, you could pay taxes, you could send your kid to school, you could get a driving license. All this here is out of the question, because without a registration with the authorities, you do not exist. You get nothing. Nothing.
To be clear, there are many workers, for example, in California, who are registered legal migrant workers who come and work on farms and then go back. And then there are those who are not.
Yeah.
Just to be clear.
Okay. Yeah, sure. But the thing is, you can be an illegal person in America and send your kid to school. Mm-hmm. You can get a driving license.
Yes. And insurance.
All that is impossible because you have no domicile here without a registration at the local community. And the same is true for Sweden, France, Spain, Italy, you name them. It's wherever you go. So without there you are on one hand, you make it once behind your frontier, you make it quite easy. They just dissolve. You have no idea where they are. I mean, with us, you have to register. If you move from place A to place B in Germany, even within a city, you have to register within a week.
And any law enforcement officer can ask you for your identity at any time without any reason.
And you have an identity card, which allows you to travel within the European Union. You have, and as a more than 16 years old, you are obliged to carry it with you. So the control here is much stricter. You have the border thing as a bulwark. That is an idea of the past. The Roman Empire had it. It was called limes. It didn't work. You either control everyone and you know where A went from B to C and why, and whether he pays his amends to his children he left behind elsewhere. All these things is control that reduces illegal immigration and reduces the degree of how they can just, well, dive under in a given society. Just in a fortified border with a minefield we had with the German Democratic Republic isn't of great help. Anyway, so the other difference is, and that has to be stressed again, we complain about direct migration within our welfare and social security systems, more the welfare systems, because they do not require insurance. And having worked here, you get it for nothing, just for being here. And you have no such thing. So here we have the problem that people from unhappier regions of the world consider it wise to risk their lives under horrible conditions to give lots of hard cash to criminals or to be employed by political criminals like Putin, who lures them to Russia, then sends them to Belarus, and they drive them across the Polish border to destabilize Poland. This has to be solved. We need the future government has to tackle this problem. If not, the extreme right will benefit from it. It's their sole issue. The AfD, and I just had a hearty laugh when I read the Musk's contribution here. It's the voice of ignorance speaking. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But the thing is, the AfD is one thing and one issue. That is race, because it's race that is they are interested in. It's race and it's xenophobia. And it's the unmanaged issue of illegal immigration. So if the government, the future one, were able to reduce this and to arrive at a solution that is acceptable and within our legal framework, wonderful. The AfD will be there without any issue. They have
issue one is the weakness of the economy.
Yeah.
Believing a political party or a chancellor can change that would be issue one. And saying issue two is migration. Mm-hmm. And issue three would be Ukraine, or is Ukraine farther down the list?
You won't find it anymore on the list.
On the list.
No, that's a construction of Putin, his quislings here in our political scenery, because they wish to destabilize our system. And you can do it by calling those responsible warmongers and interesting. All this is a crying shame. It's disgusting as an argument, and it's, of course, as false as can be. So I think the issue is, if you wish to reduce the success of the extreme right here, you have two options. The one is rather you solve the issue of illegal immigration within place, legal means. So no concentration camps and all this rubbish.
I think I totally disagree with that. The solving of the problem of illegal immigration will never happen. There is no solution to the problem.
There is.
Because, no, Gunter, because in many respects, it's a manufactured problem. It's a media problem rather than an actual problem. It's not like African migrants are taking highly paid technical jobs at German high-tech factories. I mean, it's not a thing. And the reason why it's so effective for the far right to use, and why I think it's foolish for center-right parties to keep harping on the issue, is that you can always say there's an immigration problem.
Well, there is.
But let's say something is done to fix it, and then an illegal immigrant kills some more people. You say, oh, still we have an immigration problem. I just don't see that there's a policy initiative that can so-called solve a problem when no matter what happens, there's always an immigration problem. Just look through history. People have been complaining about immigrants since there have been nations. I just don't see it. So, I mean, I just don't see it ever not being a problem. The far right forever, no matter how many walls are put up or rules, there will always be illegal immigrants. The only places that don't complain about migration are like places that no one wants to go to.
So. Well, I remember the 60s and 70s from Germany when the far right still consisted of old actively participating Nazis. And we had huge numbers. You cannot compare to what we do today, of refugees from the Eastern Bloc. And they were all welcome. That wasn't an issue at all. It started to become an issue when Madame Merkel opened the borders in 2015, unfortunately without proper preparation and limitation from the beginning. And you have to face it, there is one problem. We have 200,000, I believe. There is no right for them to stay here any longer, but they throw away their passport. They wouldn't tell you where they come from.
Gunter, there is already a policy to deal with it. It's just an ineffective government not implementing it is the point.
Yes. Yeah, if you look at
Denmark. So it's, what we're talking about is not a policy solution. What we're talking about is doing what is intended, which, you know, for whatever reason, governments don't seem to do.
Sure, you might need.
And the same goes in like the U.S. All of these illegal immigrants in the U.S. could be legally deported. It just takes a long time to go through the process, and it costs a lot of money, and lots of industries suffer. So, I mean, what I'm trying to say is the deeper you look into immigration politics and policy, the more complex it gets, the more you see that there is no fixing it. Migration will happen as it's happened throughout human history. But the one standard, the one norm is always the same. Right-wing parties always use migration for their political end, even if there's no migration problem. Even if there were no illegals in the U.S., for example, people would go after high-tech skilled worker visas, saying, oh, these are visas for foreigners. It's just always a political, you understand the point I'm making. It's always something the right will always use, no matter what reality is. And I'm just saying the reality is less bad than right-wing parties make it out to be, including Herr Merz.
Well, there's drama.
Who's just an opportunist.
There's drama in it, of course. But if you look at with what little the Danes arrived at,
Danish example, Gunther.
Yeah, but
Denmark is a ridiculous example. They have a land border that's like 60 kilometers long with Germany, and that's their only land border. It's really easy to police 60 kilometers. It's practically impossible to police, say, the American border with Canada or Mexico, or the German border, which has like 9 countries joining it.
But the Denmark border
example is a talking point that I'm not going to suffer today. Anyway, we have to move on.
We have to move on.
Let's move to the U.S. And I just want to talk about the two issues that are most important for Europe relating to Trump taking over the presidency on January 20th. Mm-hmm. So basically, the two biggest issues affecting Europe are Ukraine, support mm-hmm. for Ukraine, financial and military. And secondly, this idea of tariffs. So let's just end today quickly, Gunter. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about U.S., Europe, and Ukraine, and secondly, how mm-hmm. the U.S. and Trump's tariffs or the threats of tariffs might affect Germany and France and the EU mm-hmm. as a whole.
Europe will face, I believe, a certain conflict. The thing is, will another deal-making with the Trump administration bring about a solution, a compromise you could live with, or will it be an escalating process? So he raises tariffs for whatever European cars, and we do likewise for other
retaliatory tariffs.
Absolutely.
That's one scenario.
Yeah, that's one scenario. I remember when he first came into office that the issue was comparable, and a deal was made with the EU and America more or less avoiding at least intensifications of conflict. The tariffs as such, to an economist, are sheer nonsense. And a free world of free trade, tariffs were imposed by Bismarck to protect the German aristocracy landowners against Russian, cheap Russian imports then. That was 130 years ago. So this isn't a modern economics. This is more or less populism.
One thing I've noticed about tariffs is, as much as Trump likes to peel off countries to attack with tariffs, it seems like he always needs to be reminded that you cannot hit a certain country's products in the EU, because you don't trade with, as it were, individual countries in the EU. You don't trade with Germany. The rules are EU bloc rules. So you you can't kind of look at a single product that you want to go after, or a single country, because you're taking on the entire EU, not just, say, a product made in Poland or Malta. So my sense of the tariff game is that, as much as Trump would prefer bilateral relations economically, it's just hard to do, because the structure of the EU together forbids it.
Absolutely. And I mean, the thing is that those countries favoring Trump, maybe his ideas as well, I don't know. So that's probably the Hungarian Orban, have nothing to offer. You wouldn't have too many imports of salami from Hungary, and there's little else they can offer you. The thing is, will this escalate or not? It's hard to tell. I think if it were to escalate, rather with China, because that's the hate game, than with Europe, where a deal is probably easier to be achieved than with China.
My sense is that Trump will look for a win that can be presented to the media in the U.S. as a win for Trump and a win for the U.S. And he's always looking for wins. So if this can be negotiated and presented as a win for Trump in America, he'll do it. And I think that's the key of negotiating with him, making sure he can show a win for the American people.
Europe could offer to import more gas from America and for whatever compensation. So that could then be he had a win already, because we know, thank God, and it's the only thing I thank Trump for, is that the alarm bells sounded, that we have to invest more of our ample money, we have less public debt than you have, into our personal defense. This was mentioned first when he was against the ridiculous deal with Russia and the dependency we created on the energy, all this. He has probably unwillingly reminded us to make use of our own strength, which is
there. And that takes us to then the final point for today, which is Ukraine. Again, going back to the concept of Trump wanting a win, I don't think, first of all, that Trump will solve the war in 24 hours.
No.
But I don't want to make jokes, because it's such a serious subject. I think Trump would prefer definitely the war to end. And again, he would like to end in a way that he can claim victory, even though it's not his war, which means I don't think he could. It would reflect very poorly on him if Russian tanks rolled into Kiev.
They will never do.
Well, I'm just saying. So I don't think he's in a position where he can just sell out Ukraine. But at the same time, I think he wants the war to end. If Trump starts limiting U.S. military aid to Ukraine, do you think Europe will step up?
Yeah.
Or will Ukraine just have to fight with fewer American weapons?
America has been limping along a rather minimalistic line of support when the congressional division called for that. That was about a year ago.
Biden's been sending tons of aid
Biden's support was far less noticeable in spite of the huge numbers of money, but it was too little too late. So they should have been allowed to fire long-distance arms. I mean, giving them arms and telling them how not to use them is ridiculous. And why shouldn't they use them? I mean, if Putin were to opt for a nuclear war, He might do so tomorrow. Now, as we speak, we have nothing to stop him from this. There's just one thing that stops him from this, that is the certainty of his own death and the death of all his cronies. So you stop Putin by deterrence, not by paper he signs something on. This isn't worth a penny. All treaty with them can be thrown into the fireplace. It's like Hitler. It's absolutely like the Munich Convention, the Munich treaty they did, and they offered Czechoslovakia for nothing. So treaties with Putin are out of the question. He killed it, and there were treaties galore touching Ukraine before he invaded.
I think there has to be a solution, though. I don't think Trump will tolerate for another multiple years of war in Ukraine. He doesn't like it in the news all
the
time.
Yeah, but what could he do against supply arms to Putin?
I don't know. Well, no, he's not going to do that. Anyway, we'll see. That's a big question mark over that.
Andy, just believe me, there is nothing I should rule out with Trump. Nothing.
There's a big question mark over the tariffs. There's a big question mark over American support for Ukraine and the end of that war. I'll just remind everyone that in January 3rd, Congress is in session, and we'll start seeing some of the Republican infighting happening to select a speaker if Mike Johnson is not reelected as speaker. On January 6th, the Electoral College votes to certify the election in Congress. And of course, on January 20th, we have the inauguration of President Trump. So hopefully in those first 100 days of the administration, there will be answers to some of our questions about how American and EU relations will progress over the course of the year. And we look forward to seeing you next time then, when Gunter and I, we will discuss the results of the German election in February, okay?
Yeah, well, and the forming of a government afterwards.
And the forming of the government. Yeah. So we'll be certainly updating you on all that. Gunter, thank you for participating again today. We'll talk
Thanks
again
for
in
having
February.
Me.
And Happy New Year, everyone.
A Happy New Year to you. See you. Bye.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.